All right, last time we were talking about Mendel's experiments, and we specifically looked at one of those seven major experiments. We looked at the flower color one. Today we'll look at the explanation of those results based on chromosomes. So in slide 5, you have two chromosomes here. But notice that these are homologous chromosomes, which means that they are the same type of chromosome, right? So there's only one type of chromosome shown here. That's not to say that peas have only one type of chromosome. Their N is greater than one. But in any given genetics experiment, you pay attention to just one or two things. And in the flower color experiment, all that Mendel cared about was flower color. So all of the other chromosomes are simply ignored here. This is the only chromosome shown because this is the only chromosome in pea plants that includes a gene that has anything to do with flower color. All right, now, you already know that a single chromosome is a very long double-stranded DNA plus all of the histone proteins that are involved. But genetically, what we care about is the DNA portion. It's one huge sequence, of course, but you know that genes are subsequences within that overall sequence. And any given gene, whatever it is, exists somewhere in that overall sequence. And so physically, that means that a gene resides or exists in some location on the chromosome. And that specific location is called the locus, which is really just another name for a location. All right, now, this chromosome has many, many genes, but this is the only gene we care about, the one that exists at this position or this locus, because that's the specific gene that controls the characteristic, the only characteristic that we care about in this experiment, which is flower color. All right, now, there is therefore one flower color gene in pea plants. And that's what makes it the flower color gene as opposed to the any other kind of gene, because this protein coding gene codes for a protein that actually determines the flower color. But an important thing to understand here is that even though we're talking about one kind of gene, that doesn't mean that there's only one sequence of nucleotides for that gene. What I mean here is that a gene can have different versions and still be the same type of gene. And the reason there are different versions is why. Why is it that there can be different versions of a gene?
Redundancy?
No, that has to do with why you can have different genes actually lead to the same production of the same protein. No. It's the same answer. The question that I just gave you, which is why can there be different versions of genes, is the same answer as for the more general question, why can there be different versions of DNA? Why are there different versions of DNA? Mutation, yes. Mutation is the original source of all genetic variation. That's the reason that there are different versions of DNA to begin with. And that's why sex is successful, because once you already have different versions of DNA, then mixing it up via sex can result in a lot of possible combinations. All right, so Yes, there are different versions of genes simply because genes are sequences of DNA, and mutation makes new sequences by definition, because any mutation is a change in DNA sequence somehow. Okay? But it's still the same type of gene, even if a mutation has occurred somewhere in that sequence, because it's still a gene that controls that characteristic. All right, so this is the flower color gene. There's only one flower color gene in pea plants, and that's located at not only on this specific chromosome and not any other chromosome, but also in this specific locus, that position on that particular chromosome. The different versions that are possible for any given single gene are called alleles. And so a mutation gives rise to different alleles. Now, I said last time that Mendel's experiments all involved individually a characteristic for which there were exactly two possible traits. Remember me saying this? Which isn't always the case. But for his experiments, every single characteristic that he cared about had only two possible traits. Do you remember the difference between characteristic and trait? Is that a yes? Okay, well, now that we have these definitions from today, let me put this another way. A gene corresponds to a characteristic. And that's why we call it, for instance, the flower color gene. Because flower color is a characteristic, right? Alleles, on the other hand, correspond to traits. And in this population of pea plants, there are only two alleles for this particular gene. There's the so-called purple allele and the so-called white allele. And those are the only possibilities. All right. Now, this is a sexual species we're talking about, plants, that live their lives as multicellular diploid adults. So the cells in the body of a pea plant have diploidy, just like our own cells do, which means there are two of every type of chromosome. We're ignoring all the types of chromosomes except this one type that includes the locus for the gene whose characteristic we care about, flower color. But just like in us, this plant has two parents and therefore has two of this type of chromosome, one from its father and one from its mother. And that's why they're homologous. But notice that in this particular individual pea plant, one of the two homologs has the purple version of the allele, the purple version of the flower color gene. The purple allele is the version on one chromosome, and the white on the other. Well, that brings up some more definitions. That's one possibility. But if you assume, which we are for the moment, because it was true in this particular case, if you assume that there are... Well, actually, I don't even have to complicate it that far. This is just one possible situation with respect to this one particular characteristic, this one gene. All right, so when we refine our attention in the experiment to one characteristic, you can you can by extension say that we're paying attention to only one gene in this, because remember, gene corresponds to characteristic. But for a diploid organism, there are three possibilities. One is not shown here. One possibility would be that the individual has both of its alleles for this characteristic, both of its alleles for this gene, are the same as each other. That's not what's shown here, right? So it could be, but notice there's two ways that can happen. An individual can have both of its genes be the purple version, the purple allele, two purple alleles, or it could also be that they're both white. Well, the situation in which both of the alleles for the gene are the same as each other in that organism, in that individual, we call that homozygous. But homozygous by itself is not giving enough information because of the two ways that can happen that I just told you. Okay? Homozygous just means they're the same as each other. It doesn't tell you that they're both purple. It doesn't tell you that they're both white. It could be either. So you don't use the word homozygous by itself. Which one of these versions is dominant to the other? Purple is dominant. So if you have an individual in which both of its flower color genes are the purple version, the purple allele, then we would call that homozygous dominant. That individual would be homozygous dominant. If, on the other hand, both of them were the white allele, then we would call it homozygous recessive. The only other possibility is what we're seeing here, where you have one of each. And you might think that's two possibilities because you could have white on the top and purple on the other one, but they're really the same thing. It doesn't matter which of the two homologs the purple one appears on, it's still the same situation of having one purple version and one white version. So that's not homozygous, because homo means same. Instead, that's heterozygous, hetero meaning different. And heterozygous, unlike homozygous, is enough to say. We just use that word by itself. Right? There's only one way to have one of each of the two allele types. So homozygous stands alone as a term. In other words, we don't bother to say heterozygous dominant. That doesn't really give you any more information. Okay? Heterozygous by itself means one dominant allele, one recessive allele. Okay. Let's go on then to 6 and revisit this same experiment we've been talking about. This is the same exact cross that we've already talked about and that we ended up with last time. What kind of cross is this? It is a hybrid cross, but more specifically,
monohybrid.
It's a monohybrid cross. Why?
Because it's focusing on one characteristic.
Right. That's what makes it mono, and what makes it a hybrid. So flower color, that's what you mean by one characteristic. We only pay attention to one characteristic here. That's flower color. That's the mono part of monohybrid. What's the hybrid part? Not exactly. It means that the two parents that you're crossing differ in their trait for that one characteristic that you're paying attention to. So flower color is all you care about. It's a hybrid cross if one parent is different from the other in their flower color. And they are here. One of them is the purple colored version, the other is the white colored version. All right. So that's what makes it a monohybrid cross. It's time for a couple more definitions now. one of which is phenotype. And really, phenotype means pretty much the same thing as trait. A phenotype is the description of an individual's trait for a given characteristic. And we therefore use phrases, words, to indicate phenotype, like purple flowered. That's a phenotype. Okay? But that's also a trait, right? That's a specific trait of flower color. White flowered is also a phenotype. Any given individual has a specific phenotype for any given characteristic. But a similar sounding word is genotype. Genotype refers to the specific alleles or allele, depending on what type of cell you're talking about, that an individual has, or that a cell of that individual really more specifically has. So we don't use phrases to describe genotype like purple flowered. Instead, we use some string of symbols. The symbols actually represent specific alleles. So the actual genetic makeup is what the genotype is. But we're just ignoring all the rest of the DNA except that one gene that we care about, its locus. Well, we see phenotypes listed here next to appearance. Purple flowers and white flowers, those are phenotypes. Just under that, you see genetic makeup. Well, those are the genotypes, those strings of P's, the letter P's, not the fruit that we're looking at here. So notice that this, well, remember, first of all, that not only is this a hybrid cross, so the parents differ in their traits, but also he made sure before he started that both of these parents were true breeding individuals, right? It's not just a purple flowered individual for one parent, it's a true breeding purple flowered individual. Well, in terms of other definitions that we learned today, what's another word or another phrase for true breeding? For true breeding purple, what's another phrase for that? Yes, exactly. Homozygous dominant is another way of saying true breeding. True breeding means that both of your two alleles for that specific gene are of the same type. And therefore, a true breeding purple, since purple is the dominant allele, would be a homozygous dominant individual. And a true breeding white flowered individual, since white is recessive, would be homozygous recessive. We can see that in the symbols that are used, which is kind of confusing at first, but it makes good sense. Notice that all we're dealing here on the genotypes are the letters P for both purple and white. Now, P itself here stands for purple. Or in general, we use a letter that is the initial for the representing the dominant trait. Purple is dominant over white, so we use the P of purple to indicate that. But P doesn't mean, I mean, we don't use a W for white. Instead, we use uppercase P's to represent purple alleles. More correctly, we use an uppercase P to represent a purple allele. And we use a lowercase p, which you can tell apart from an uppercase P, to represent a white allele. By using P instead of W, but the lowercase version, we can keep track of the fact that purple is still dominant, even though when we're using a lowercase, what we're referring to is a white allele. All right? Now, there are two P's in each individual's genotype. And that represents the fact that these individuals are diploid. A diploid individual, by definition, has two alleles for the gene you're interested in, right? One on each of the two homologous chromosomes that carry the locus for that gene. You following all these definitions? And so you can tell that at a glance by looking at a genotype, whether it's haploid or diploid. If it were a haploid cell, there would be only one P, either uppercase or lowercase, depending on which allele is at the locus in that single chromosome of that type that a haploid cell would have. Right? Because a haploid cell has only one of each type of chromosome. So we can see just by the fact that there are two symbols that these are diploid individuals. Well, this is a true breeding because it's upper-upper P. Upper-upper P means homozygous dominant. They're both uppercase. They're both the dominant version. Lower-lower P means homozygous recessive. It's diploid because there's two P's. It's homozygous because they're both lowercase. And it's recessive because they are lowercase. All right, so those are the genotypes. When these two parents are crossed, meaning that they undergo successful fertilization, the thing that defines sex, remember, that means their alleles are fused, right? By definition, that's what fertilization is. But before that can happen, the two parents individually have to, first of all, make those gametes. And what process produces gametes out of diploid cells? Meiosis. So meiosis has to occur in this parent and it has to occur in this parent. Well, when meiosis occurs, you know that there's going to be multiple cells made, right? Specifically, four cells made. But one of those is going to be randomly chosen, and one from the other parent, to get together in fertilization to produce the zygote, right? So, for meiosis to occur, one of these two alleles, because each allele is carried on its own chromosome, is chosen for each of the cells that result. If you are true breeding, or homozygous, it doesn't matter which one gets randomly chosen by meiosis. Any given gamete, in other words, is going to have an uppercase P chosen in its gamete, because that's the only choices you can make. It doesn't matter which chromosome gets chosen by meiosis, it's going to be an uppercase P carried by that. That all makes sense? Same thing for the white-flowered individual, except the only choice is lowercase P. So when all you care about is, I mentioned before that there are almost infinitely many different gametes that can be produced by each parent, which is true when you consider all characteristics. But when all you care about is flower color, that means that each of these two parents, being true breeding, can produce only one kind of egg or sperm, only one kind of gamete, because of the fact that they are homozygous. All right. So if this purple-flowered one is the female, every egg it produces is going to have an uppercase P. And if this is the male, every sperm it produces is going to include a lowercase P, a white allele. Therefore, it doesn't matter really which egg and sperm of these individuals get together when all you care about is flower color. Because every zygote will therefore be a combination of an uppercase P and a lowercase P. It will get a purple allele from one parent and a white allele from the other, and therefore every possible zygote of the almost infinitely possible, many possible ones that could be produced will have a diploid genotype that is uppercase P, lowercase p. So notice that we went from diploidy in the parents to haploidy in the gametes, back to diploidy because fertilization doubles the ploidy again. All right? So this is not saying that one offspring is produced. There were hundreds of offspring produced. But every one of them had exactly the same genotype with respect to flower color. Every one of the F1 zygotes, and therefore every one of the full adult plants in the F1 generation that grew from those zygotes, have the same genotype with respect to flower color. Uppercase, lowercase p. And that explains why they all looked alike. He saw no white ones at all in that. And that's because white is recessive. Purple is dominant. Now that we see it this way, it's easier to define dominance. The dominant trait is the one for which only one allele is enough to confer that trait onto the individual. There's two ways that you can be purple genetically, purple flowered. You could have one purple allele and the other one white, but one is enough. Or you could have both of them be purple, which of course you're still going to be purple. Okay? But the dominant allele requires only one allele to fully give that dominant trait. That's why they're not only all purple, they're all fully purple. Just as purple as the true breeding adult. I mean, a true breeding parent that was purple. None of these F1s, though, are true breeding now, right? They're all heterozygous. Because they have both types of alleles. And you never know what they're going to pass on to any of their offspring. All right, so we see that right here. Purple flowers is the phenotype. It's 100% of the F1s, however many hundreds there were, had the same phenotype, and 100% of them had the same genotype, upper lower P. All right, now, when we cross two F1s to produce the F2, the process is the same. Each parent has to make gametes. But we're starting with different parents now. These are no longer true breeding. Right? You cross one heterozygous individual with another heterozygous individual. So the abbreviation for the cross would be upper lower P. You do it with their genotypes. X is the cross, upper lower P. That means one heterozygous crossed with another heterozygous. That's what Mendel did when he took two F1s and put them together. And he did the same thing hundreds of times. But the same thing is happening in each of these two parents. They first have to make gametes, right? Using meiosis. Meiosis randomly chooses a chromosome for each cell that's produced. That's what independent assortment was all about. But in this case, it does matter which one randomly gets chosen, because there are both types of alleles available here. So this individual can produce gametes of two types with respect to flower color. An uppercase P gamete, and notice gametes have haploid genotypes. So an egg or a sperm has only one P in it for its genotype because it's haploid, not diploid. Well, that's one type. Or you could randomly choose the other chromosome, which would be a lowercase p as the haploid genotype. This other one can make exactly the same kinds of genotypes, but the other kind of gamete. So either egg or sperm. Everyone clear on all of that? Okay, well, Remember, I talked about random fertilization, which refers to the fact that once the gametes are produced beforehand by each parent, one of them is selected at random from each parent, and those two random selections are gotten together to produce the zygote. So once again, there's almost infinite combinations when you consider everything, but we're not considering everything. We're ignoring everything except flower color. So when you restrict your attention only to flower color, you can mathematically figure out exactly how many different types of zygotes with respect only to flower color can be produced by these specific two parents. All you have to do is mix and match the possible gametes that they're able to produce. And that is done in a shorthand method called a Punnett square, which is what you have here on the bottom, named after a dead Englishman called Punnett. Now, the Punnett square really is just showing you what's happening for a particular cross. What is possible to happen in a particular cross? Okay, it's an exhaustive listing of all possible outcomes. But it represents a real biological process. What is the process that's being represented? What is a cross when you get down to processes? What process is happening in a cross? Biological process. No. That's happening in gamete formation. They're all doing that before they know anything about the other parent. And in plants, they never know anything about the other parent because they're not even meeting. No. That's not really a process. That's a manifestation of a process.
Fertilization.
That is what a cross is, right? It's not a cross unless fertilization occurs. And what is fertilization? The fusion of two unicellular gametes to produce one, what? Unicellular zygote. Okay, so we have this Punnett square, and there are different sizes of Punnett squares. This one is made up of four boxes. What does each box represent? Yes, but give me the name. It corresponds to a genotype, but what real thing is it? A zygote, exactly. Each box in a Punnett square represents one possible zygote that these two particular parents could produce with respect to the one characteristic that you care about in this cross. So yes, they can produce almost infinitely many types of zygotes, except it's narrowing down to only one characteristic that you care about. And these particular parents can produce these four zygotes when all you care about is flower color. Because this is an exhaustive listing of all the possible flower color arrangements of alleles when you get together the gametes from these two particular parents. Listed on one side and to the top of the square are the genotypes representing the possible gametes each of the two parents can produce. Right? So remember that each parent is an uppercase, lowercase p as a diploid parent. Meiosis randomly chooses them, so the eggs possible are individually an uppercase version or in a lowercase version. Those are put on one side. These are the only two kinds of eggs she can produce with respect to flower color. Similarly, he can produce either an uppercase P sperm or a lowercase P sperm. Therefore, if these two parents undergo fertilization, it has to be either this one with this one, this one with this one, this one with this one, or this one with this one. The Punnett square, in other words, lists all possible zygotes that those two particular parents can produce. You simply match up gametes, row and column. And notice that those gametes are haploid genotypes, as they should be, right? And when you get them together to make the boxes, you are producing a diploid zygote with two P's, as fertilization does. Fertilization doubles diploidy. So, notice that three of these four, well, before I get into that, this does not at all tell you how many individual offspring are produced. You could produce one offspring or a million offspring from these two parents. This just tells you any individual zygote has to be one of these four things. All right. But keep in mind the dominance relationship here. Purple is dominant to white, which means all it takes is one, at least, uppercase P, one purple allele, to make you a purple-flowered individual. Well, there's at least one uppercase P in three-fourths of these zygotes that are possible. This one is homozygous dominant. These two are heterozygous. But they're all equally purple because all it takes is one uppercase P to make you purple. And notice that the only way to become recessive is to be homozygous recessive, because that's the only way to not have a purple allele, which would make you purple instead of white. And then finally, notice that this Punnett square gives you a prediction of what the phenotypic ratio should be in the real offspring of these two particular parents. And notice that this predicts 3-to-1, three dominant individuals for every one recessive individual, which is exactly what Mendel got when he did his experiment. So in the F2 generation, there is a 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio for a monohybrid cross if the gene behaves in a Mendelian fashion, which this one does. All right? And therefore, this is Mendelian genetics. Now, for a gene to behave in a Mendelian fashion and for this 3-to-1 ratio to keep coming up in the F2, there have to be two things that are true. One is that there have to be exactly two alleles for the gene, which is another way of saying there have to be exactly two possible traits for the characteristic, as I've discussed before. Well, there is in this case. This is a Mendelian case. That's one that's one criterion for Mendelianity. The other requirement is that one of those two alleles has to be completely dominant over the other, which isn't always true, as we'll examine later, but it is in this case. Okay, so if you have exactly two alleles for whatever gene you're talking about, and one of them is completely dominant over the other, then if you undergo a monohybrid cross, it doesn't matter what characteristic, you're still going to end up with an F2 generation that features a 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio, three dominant individuals to one recessive. And in the F1, you're not going to get any recessives because they're all going to be heterozygous. Well, if you have complete dominance, heterozygous individuals are always going to be dominant, right? Because a heterozygous individual has one dominant, one recessive allele. All of those definitions make sense. Anything that doesn't at all? All right. Well, slide 7 shows you on the left that you have in the F2 generation for a monohybrid cross, you have a 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio. But there's, because of complete dominance, there's two different phenotypes that both correspond to the same phenotype, purple. So although you have a 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio in the F2, you have a 1-to-2-to-1 genotypic ratio. Let me momentarily go back to the Punnett square. There's only two phenotypes here, so there's two numbers used in that ratio, 3-to-1. But there's three different genotypes, right? Homozygous dominant, heterozygous, and homozygous recessive. So for the genotypic ratio, it's 1-to-2-to-1. That's what the right side of slide 7 is showing. Okay, now let's talk about what's happening in 8. This is not the same experiment, even though it's flower color we're looking at here. This is a special technique called a test cross. Now, just for a little bit of background, if you have a situation, a Mendelian situation, meaning there are two possible traits, one of which is dominant to the other, totally, completely dominant over the other. Purple is completely dominant over white flowers in this case. Well, if you just look at a white-flowered individual, or for any recessive trait for whatever characteristic, if it's Mendelian. But if you just look at a white-flowered individual, you don't have to get in there and examine its DNA. You know just by how complete dominance works, just by looking at it, being white-flowered, that it must be homozygous recessive. In other words, for a recessive individual in Mendelian genetics, observation of the phenotype, the specific trait, for a recessive individual is enough to give you the genotype. Because there's only one possible genotype for recessivity. But if you observe an individual with a dominant trait, you don't know the genotype, right? You know the phenotype because that's what you're observing, purple flowered. But you don't know the genotype because there's two ways to become dominant traited, right? Either by being homozygous dominant or by being heterozygous. So all you know is the phenotype by direct observation, and sometimes it's really useful to know the genotype. For instance, if you're a breeder, you might want to only be dealing with true breeding individuals so that you don't have any white flowers possible. Well, you can't tell that by looking at a parent, right? If it's purple flowered. So a test cross is designed to figure out the genotype of a dominant phenotype individual. In this case, the purple individual. White's no problem, you know that already. But if you have a dominant individual, and you want to know, in this case, whether it's upper P or upper P, in other words, homozygous dominant or heterozygous, then you can cross that individual with a recessive individual, lower P. Before you actually go through with crossing them, though, you can just predict what these two scenarios would result in. So there's two Punnett squares here shown for this test cross because there's two possibilities. One is that the purple one is upper P. The other one is that it's upper lower P, right? Each one of those two possibilities results in a different Punnett square with this white one, depending on which one is true. But you go ahead and make both Punnett squares, giving you both sets of predictions. Each Punnett square represents the predictions. And if this purple-flowered individual is homozygous, that means it's upper P, then the only gametes it can make are uppercase P. The only gametes the white-flowered one you're crossing it with can be lowercase p. And therefore, that would predict 100% of the offspring being heterozygous and therefore purple-flowered. On the other hand, if the purple-flowered one is heterozygous, then it can make an uppercase egg or a lowercase egg. And in that case, when you cross it with the white-flowered one, you're going to get two out of four being heterozygous, and the other two out of the four being homozygous recessive. Meaning, however many offspring are produced, half of them should be purple-flowered and half should be white-flowered. All right, those are the predictions. Then you actually go ahead with the cross. You go ahead and do it and look at the offspring. Well, if you have even one white-flowered individual appear, that means this can't be true, right? Because white is impossible in this prediction. So one or more whites proves that that purple-flowered one originally was heterozygous, not homozygous. That's what the test cross allows you to do. Now, depending on what the number is, if you only get purple-flowered, it at least tells you this could be true. But you might have just gotten lucky and gotten purple ones, and it still could be this one's true, right? That's why if you let them have enough offspring and it's a big number and they're all purple, then the odds are pretty good that this one's true. That's a test cross. Okay, now to 9. This is a new cross in two respects. One is that we're no longer paying attention to flower color here. But another is that we are no longer paying attention to just one characteristic. So this is not a monohybrid cross, this is a dihybrid cross. What are the two characteristics? Just looking at the original parents. Right. Seed color, color of the peas themselves, which are the seeds, and the seed texture. Those are two completely independent characteristics. Okay, but you're paying attention to both of them at the same time. If this were a monohybrid cross, you would pay attention to only the color or only the texture and ignore what the other one is. Okay, but we're paying attention to both here. This is a dihybrid cross, though, so once again, the parents differ. It's just that they differ in both traits because there's two characteristics, therefore each parent has two traits that we're paying attention to. This one is yellow with respect to color and smooth with respect to texture. The other parent differs in both of those characteristics, the traits for both of those characteristics. It's green instead of yellow, and it's wrinkled instead of smooth. Okay, now, this is also Mendelian, so that means for each of these two characteristics, there's only two possible traits, two alleles for the gene, in other words. And those two possibilities are yellow and green for color and smooth and wrinkled for texture. But also, that's not enough for it to be Mendelian. Remember, for it to be Mendelian, it also has to be true that one of the two alleles needs to completely dominate over the other. And looking at the genotypes, what's the dominant color?
Yellow.
Yellow, which is why Y was chosen for both yellow and green. But uppercase Y means yellow, lowercase Y means green. What about texture?
Wrinkled.
Wrinkled is recessive. I said smooth and wrinkled, but they chose R for round, meaning round and smooth mean the same thing. So uppercase R means the actual round allele version, and lowercase R means the wrinkled version for the allele. Notice that these genotypes for each of these two original parents are four symbols long. But that's because you have to have different symbols for each of the two characteristics that you're tracking. What about diploidy? What does upper, upper Y, upper, upper R mean, diploidy-wise? Means diploid, right. There's two Ys and there's two Rs, so that's a diploid individual. It's just you're simultaneously giving the genotypes for two separate characteristics that you are simultaneously tracking. And similarly, lower, lower Y, lower, lower R is a diploid genotype. But notice that each of these parents is doubly homozygous. The yellow round one is a double homozygous dominant individual. Homozygous dominant with respect to color, homozygous dominant with respect to texture. The other parent is a doubly homozygous recessive individual. Homozygous recessive with respect to color, in other words, green, and homozygous recessive with respect to texture, in other words, wrinkled. Okay, so it's clearly a dihybrid cross because of all that, right? Two characteristics, and the parents differ in their traits. Well, now you have two genes to keep track of, but exactly the same thing has to occur. When you produce gametes via meiosis, you go from diploid to haploid, right? Which means just one of those two alleles from each parent gets chosen for each characteristic. So you choose one of these Ys, you choose one of these Rs. Well, these are true breeding individuals. So it doesn't matter which Y is chosen from this or which R. Every gamete is going to be upper Y, upper R from this parent. It's the only possibility. And every gamete from the other parent is going to be lower Y, lower R. Notice that those are haploid genotypes, as they should be for gametes. And since each of these parents can produce only one kind of gamete with respect to these two characteristics, that means every one of the offspring making up the F1 generation will have exactly the same genotype with respect to these two characteristics. Every one of the zygotes is going to be upper Y, upper R, lower R. In other words, doubly heterozygous. And since there is complete dominance of yellow over green and complete dominance of round over wrinkled, that means every doubly heterozygous individual is going to be doubly dominant. Dominant color and dominant texture. In other words, just like the picture, yellow and smooth or round. This is just like the monohybrid cross, right? Every one of the F1s is dominant and heterozygous, but now it's like doing two crosses at the same time. Well, now you can cross these to do the F2. But notice that there's two different Punnett squares shown here. Only one of them is correct, but Each of these Punnett squares represents the predictions that correspond to two hypotheses, each of two hypotheses. So notice that these hypotheses are, in one case, that there is dependent assortment, and the other hypothesis is that there is independent assortment. Well, you already know which one of these is true because I've told you this, right? Which one is true? Right, there is independent assortment. What does assortment refer to? Not that is an ultimate effect, but it really refers to something a little earlier, before there is any division. Yes, how a single tetrad lines up at metaphase. Just one tetrad of however many there are in the individual, and how many are there in general? How many tetrads? Right? No, it doesn't depend on the ploidy. It depends on what? Yes, but what is the answer in general for how many tetrads line up? N. Any given cell has N tetrads if it's diploid. Right? Well, assortment by itself refers to only how one of those N tetrads lines up. If there were dependent assortment, then that means there would only be one coin tossed for the entire cell. And all tetrads would obey that same coin. So remember, we were talking about red and blue versions of the chromosomes. With dependent assortment, they would line up either all red up and all blue down, or all blue up and all red down. That's what dependent assortment means. And that's one hypothesis. Independent assortment means each tetrad flips its own coin. But if we assume that dependent assortment is true, then that means you should only be able to make these kinds of zygotes in this smaller Punnett square. Because of that dependent assortment, meaning you should get a 3-to-1 ratio of parental types, as they're called. Parental type phenotypes are phenotypes that are like one parent or the other. Notice that these three are exactly like one parent. They are both yellow and round. This one is also a parental type because it's like the other parent. It's both green and wrinkled. All right? And if there's dependent assortment, all you should get are parental types in a 3-to-1 ratio. If there's independent assortment, though, then there can be all possibilities, all four possible combinations of phenotypes. You have four phenotypes here, right? Yellow and green, and round and wrinkled. And if independent assortment happens, then you should be able to get all four possible combinations. In other words, you should be able to get yellow and round, yellow and wrinkled, green and round, and green and wrinkled. And that's why this Punnett square has 16 boxes in it. There are 16 possible zygotes if each parent can make four different sperm. These, you know, if you have these four to work with in both parents. Uppercase Y, lowercase Y, uppercase R, lowercase R. Meiosis is going to pick a Y and an R randomly. But you can do that four ways.
upper Y, upper R, upper Y, lower R, lower Y, upper R, lower Y, lower R. That's why each of these parents has four possible gametes. And therefore, when you get those together, there's 16 ways you can do it. All right? Well, I've already told you that independent assortment is what really happens. So when they went through with this, this set of predictions came true, not this one. So there is independent assortment, and therefore, in a dihybrid cross for a Mendelian situation, the F2 should feature a 9 to 3 to 3 to 1 ratio, phenotypic ratio. 9 of these will be doubly homozygous dominant. Doubly dominant. So dominant. Dominant color, dominant texture. 3 of them should be dominant color, recessive texture. 3 of them should be recessive color, dominant texture. And only one of them, there's only one way you get these gametes together to produce a doubly recessive individual, both green and wrinkled. Because you need 2 lowercase y's and 2 lowercase r's. There's only these two gametes can do that. All right? But if you know that your two genes that you care about are Mendelian, and you do a dihybrid cross for those two characteristics, the F2, regardless of the characteristics, are going to feature a 9 to 3 to 3 to 1 ratio. That's a phenotypic ratio. The genotypic ratio would be much more complicated, right? Because you have a lot of different genotypes. But there's 4 possible phenotypes. Slide 10 just shows you that you can represent fertilization as coin tosses, really. This just represents the randomness of random fertilization. Punnett square shows you the possible gametes that each parent can produce, but random fertilization says you randomly choose one of these gametes from each of the two parents to get together to produce that particular zygote. So in the case where you have heterozygous crossed with heterozygous, like in the F1s crossed with the F1s, then each of those can produce 2 gamete types, therefore that's a flip of the coin, and each of them has the same probability, 1/2. And therefore, to get together 2 specific gametes to produce 1 specific zygote type, the overall probability is the product of the individual probabilities. It's a probability of 1/2 to pick this egg, probability of 1/2 to predict this sperm, so that zygote has a probability of 1/2 times 1/2, or 1/4. So does each of the others, and they all those probabilities add up to 1, which means 100%. Those are all the possibilities. All right, now that is Mendelian genetics. Those are the basics of Mendelian genetics. And so make sure you have a handle on those before we go on to the rest of this chapter, which is non-Mendelian genetics. All right, let's quickly review what it means to be Mendelian. What has to be true for Mendelian genetics? What did I just tell you? It's not enough information.
There has to be 2 possible traits, and one has to be totally different from the other.
Yes, exactly 2 traits for whatever characteristic is being tracked is one requirement. Not 2 or more, exactly 2. Okay, for it to be Mendelian. And what was the second?
One has to be completely dominant over the other.
Right. One of those 2 traits has to be completely dominant over the other, or you could say it the corresponding way, one of those 2 alleles has to be completely dominant over the other. Because if you think about it in terms of characteristic, it's one characteristic that you're tracking, then there are 2 traits. If you think about it in terms of tracking one gene, since a characteristic corresponds to a gene, then you would say the Mendelian requirement is that for any gene, there have to be exactly two possible alleles. That's just another way of restating, though, what I said earlier today. A gene corresponds to a characteristic. An allele corresponds to a trait within that characteristic. Okay, so that means any way that you violate those requirements means you're no longer dealing with Mendelian genetics. And therefore, you don't get those predictable ratios that we just went through in Mendelian genetics. That 3-to-1 for a monohybrid cross in the F2, that 9-to-3 to 3-to-1 in the F2 of a dihybrid cross. Those break down in non-Mendelian genetics. And like I said earlier or last time, if he hadn't been dealing with Mendelian genetics, it would have been confusing as hell to figure out for Mendel, because he had no idea what chromosome is. Well, the first exception to Mendelian genetics, so this is the first example of non-Mendelian genetics, is shown in slide 11. And this particular exception is called incomplete dominance. And right away, just the phrase itself tells you that this is not Mendelian genetics, right? Because one of the requirements for Mendelian genetics is to have complete dominance. This is called incomplete dominance. So obviously not Mendelian. How many characteristics are we dealing with here? No? One. What is it? Flower color. Yes. This is not a pea plant, but its flower color is the one characteristic. How many traits?
Three.
Three traits. So you can see that's not Mendelian, right? The three traits are, as you see, red, white, and pink. Now, these are genotypes, even though they are listed a different way. This is incomplete dominance, not complete dominance. When you have complete dominance, the Mendelian case, then you write your genotypes the way we've already learned them, meaning one letter that corresponds to the dominant trait is used. Uppercase means dominant, lowercase means recessive, right? That's how we've been doing it. Here, though, we don't have one that is completely dominant over the other. And so this is a different standard of genotypes. The C here refers to the coloration gene, the flower color gene, in other words. And then as a superscript on that C, you indicate the particular allele. R for red, W for white. All right? Now, red is dominant over white here. So it's not that it's complete lack of dominance, it's just not complete dominance. So think about what complete dominance means. If you have complete dominance, which we don't here, then having just one dominant allele is enough to fully give you the dominant phenotype, which is why the F1 purple-flowered individuals were fully purple, just like the true-breeding homozygous adult. In incomplete dominance, though, there is still a dominance relationship, in this case red over white, but the only way to be fully red is to be homozygous red, homozygous dominant. Both of your two alleles as a diploid individual have to be the red version to be completely red. Both of them have to be white to be a white-flowered individual. And the only other possibility, of course, is to be heterozygous, right? To have a red version and a white version. And in that case, it's more like what we would have thought was the prediction originally, right? The offspring is a blending of phenotypes between the parents. So it's reddish-white or pink. And it just depends on how that particular protein works. Right? It's not that anything is being done differently because it's non-Mendelian. It's just that the results look different to us. For some genes, you know, think about what genes are doing. These are protein-coding genes, right? So when they are activated, that means they're transcribed, produce mRNA. The mRNA then gets translated and a protein is produced, right? Well, if you are a homozygous dominant individual, this red flower one, then that means you have twice as many red protein-producing genes as a heterozygous individual would have, right? Therefore, in the same amount of time, you can transcribe twice as much mRNA that's red. And therefore, in the same amount of time, make twice as much red protein than one that only has one allele that's red. And for certain cases, that makes a difference. For purple-flowered individuals, for whatever reason, it's enough simply to make only half as much. But here it matters. So nothing's different about this fundamentally. It's just this particular case works differently. All right? Notice the Punnett square, though. The prediction is not the 3-to-1, because there aren't any longer two ways to become red. There's only one way to be red, homozygous. Only one way to be white, homozygous. And two ways to be pink, meaning red from the mother, white from the father, white from the mother, red from the father. But genotypically, those are the same thing, right? In terms of how many of the four that is, though, it's still two pinks out of four. So it's a 1-to-2-to-1 phenotypic ratio in incomplete dominance. One dominant to two partially or intermediate phenotypes to one recessive phenotype. This one's actually a little more than 4 minutes complicated, so I'll stop there.